From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week...
I recognize that the media is all eager to talk about an alliance. There is no alliance.
John Kasich made the decision in his own political self-interest to withdraw from Indiana.
That's Ted Cruz disavowing the supposed alliance between himself and John Kasich that the media had been tripping over itself to cover earlier this week.
Kasich will stop campaigning in Indiana, and Cruz will do the same in Oregon and New Mexico.
Trying to block Donald Trump from racking up enough delegates to win outright before the convention.
How did they ever get such an idea? Well, in part because Ted Cruz and John Kasich said so.
It is big news today that John Kasich has decided to pull out of Indiana to give us a head-to-head contest with Donald Trump.
For his part, Kasich's top strategist, John Weaver, tweeted, quote, "I can't stand liars." Although, of course, he could have been talking about anything. Thus concluded the latest and most bungled scheme of the 2016 GOP campaign season. If nothing else, it gave the current frontrunner plenty to work with.
They are really trying to stop me. Everybody knows it. Everybody sees it.
Thing is, he's not entirely wrong. The GOP has been trying to come up with a way to stop Trump ever since it realized he wasn't just going away. But if Trump and his supporters are scandalized, they shouldn't be surprised.
In fact, journalist and historian Rick Perlstein says that the GOP's Stop Trump movement is just the latest chapter in a long history of election scheming. Just ask Barry Goldwater in 1964.
He was seen as an extremist, a part of a movement that had taken over the party establishment from the ground up. He spoke of the cravenness of not being willing to challenge the Soviet Union because of fear of nuclear war. He was speaking of doing things like making Social Security voluntary. He had voted against the Civil Rights Act at a time in which civil rights workers were being murdered in cold blood in Mississippi. He was even, like Mr. Trump, endorsed by the Ku Klux Klan. When he gave his convention speech, which is traditionally a ritual of reconciliation in which you usher all the conflicts of the past under the bridge, instead of doing that, he said,
"That extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice."
Which was precisely what he was not supposed to say. In fact, Richard Nixon said that when he heard it, he was sick to his stomach.
Let's just cycle back before that convention speech. In the primaries, the party was trying to stop him.
Right. How? The first attempt to stop him was beating him at the ballot box. Nelson Rockefeller ran. He lost a very decisive primary in California. And, you know, after that, the party establishment tried to draft a likely contender, but they couldn't find anyone. There was a fellow named William Warren Scranton, the handsome and charismatic governor of Pennsylvania, who they called the Hamlet of Harrisburg because he refused to step up to the plate. Finally, he did a few weeks before the convention. It was far too late. Barry Goldwater glided to the first ballot victory.
And when Scranton did finally decide, he sent a letter to the delegates that was decidedly, in the parlance of our day, smug.
The leaders couldn't believe that the party had been stolen from underneath their nose. And William Warren Scranton, this very waspy name, sends this open letter directed to Barry Goldwater in which he said, "The delegates are not a flock of chickens whose neck you can wring at will." The idea that somehow they were being manipulated, that, of course, made the delegates only more resentful of this elite. They were, in fact, gung-ho for Barry Goldwater. Many of them had been recruited at the precinct level. That's how they took over the party, from the bottom up.
Goldwater became the eventual nominee, at which point the party fell in line and supported their candidate full-throatedly.
Rather not. You see in the archives letters to Lyndon Johnson, phone calls to Lyndon Johnson from Republican senators pledging their loyalty to, in fact, the Democratic ticket. You have people who wouldn't appear on stage with Barry Goldwater. The only guy who would was this sad sack, pathetic guy, Richard Nixon, and everyone knew that his career was finished.
And the media?
There was a paper called the New York Herald Tribune. It basically was Horace Greeley's paper. It was a paper that was there at the founding of the Republican Party, associated as closely with the Republican Party as the Wall Street Journal was associated with Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And they resoundingly turned against Barry Goldwater. Time magazine was seen as a Republican magazine. They turned against Barry Goldwater. All these Republican newspapers in towns and burghs across America turned away from their historic allegiance to the Republican Party because the Republican Party had plainly gone crazy.
So what about 4 years later, 1968? Mm-hmm. Did the party then get its act together and find a candidate it could endorse?
The first thing I heard when I saw that Kasich and Cruz were kind of conspiring to deny Donald Trump the nomination was something that allegedly happened in 1968. Ronald Reagan entered the campaign at the last minute, literally announced his campaign at the convention, which is inconceivable now. And Nelson Rockefeller was running for president, too. And supposedly, Rockefeller and Reagan said, if we both get in and deny Richard Nixon the 50% of the delegates plus one that he needs to win on the first ballot, as the metaphor put it, we'll have tipped the football. And there was kind of a gentleman's agreement that then we'll see who can catch the Hail Mary pass and carry it across the goal line. But until then, we're basically working together. It didn't work. Richard Nixon made a deal with the South in the person of Senator Strom Thurmond, promising not to enforce civil rights laws, and that took away Southern support from Ronald Reagan. Once again, a second ballot was not achieved, as in fact a second ballot has not been achieved since the 1940s.
Hmm. Now, 1964 and 1968 were both back in the days of the smoke-filled room.
Very much so.
Before the system of primaries we currently have took hold, party leaders could secretly handpick convention delegates.
Yes, they had something called favorite son candidates. So let's say you're a governor of a big state like California, and you would basically pronounce yourself a presidential candidate. You weren't really running for president. Basically, you held the entire delegation, those dozens and dozens of delegates in your pocket, and you became a power broker. Things changed after 1968 when the Democrats, following the defeat of Hubert Humphrey and the absolute debacle at the convention in Chicago.
Now, let us point out that Hubert Humphrey famously snagged that nomination without participating in a single primary.
Exactly. And since he lost, the reformist faction in the party had basically a pretty strong argument to make some changes. And the changes they made in a commission that was chaired by Senator George McGovern was that we were going to put the choice to the party rank and file through primaries, which were in very limited application before that point.
And so then 1972 rolled around, and
the party rank and file chose as their standard bearer George McGovern, who was considered by the party elite way too much of an outsider. Our friend Mr. Nixon, who's now the president of the United States, his minions were out there trying to sabotage the Democratic candidates that they considered more viable in a general election. Again, Hubert Humphrey, the Maine senator, Edmund Muskie. The one candidate that they never sabotaged was this guy, George McGovern, because he couldn't win.
Mm-hmm.
He did win. Once again, a convention in which first ballot victory was still in doubt. He ends up with the nomination.
But the Democratic Party leadership was really mad.
That's right. In fact, a Democratic senator gave a blind quote to the columnists Evans and Novak saying that George McGovern was the candidate of acid amnesty and abortion. Turned out that that very senator was Thomas Eagleton, who McGovern chose as his running mate. And Hubert Humphrey, in a phone call to Richard Nixon congratulating him for his victory, very much makes it seem to me, at least, that he had worked for his own candidate's defeat.
Mr. President, Hubert, how are you?
Well, fine, and I wanted to call up just to congratulate you on the historic victory.
Well, thank you very much. You've been a very statesmanlike man, but I felt you had to fight for your man. I understood why, but I know that you didn't approve of some of the tactics.
Well, I'll have a talk with you sometime. I did what I had to do.
Of course you did.
If not, Mr. President, this whole defeat would have been blamed on me and some
associates. That's right. That's right.
I know that.
That's right. Well, we'll get together and we'll work for the good of the country. That's the important thing.
Surely will.
So, you know, poor McGovern, he wants to pivot to the center, but the establishment of the party isn't going to let him. When it comes to, you know, acid and amnesty and abortion, Nixon and McGovern basically had the same position on abortion, and they had a similar position on decriminalizing marijuana. But the point is power. The old establishment of the party fought back. Every time one of these insurgencies either wins or looks like it's going to win, they change the rules for next time. For example, the Democrats, to make sure that an established candidate won, you know, established something like Super Tuesday, where they had a bunch of Southern primaries on one day. Well, lo and behold, who won Super Tuesday in 1984? It was Jesse Jackson. The lesson for the parties is that democracy is a messy thing. And if you're going to change the rules to try to control the rules, you may find yourself with egg on your face at the end.
Rick, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Rick Perlstein is a journalist, historian, and author most recently of The Invisible Bridge, The Fall of Nixon and the Rise of Reagan.
The GOP maneuvering of 1964 and the shadowy Democratic sabotage of 1972 are both modern cases of nominee jiggering. But for the example that may hold the best clues to what's happening now, we offer for your consideration the election of 1824, which presented four candidates, one, that's right, just one party, and the mother of all backroom deals.
And the result was something approaching total chaos.
Daniel Feller is a professor of history at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. He lays out how campaigns in 1824 were rather different from today, in that candidates didn't actually campaign.
An idea going back to the American Revolution, really, and to the fear of executive power, is that somebody who wanted the presidency enough to actively seek it, probably for that very reason, was a dangerous man who shouldn't have it.
Another difference, the early parties, the Federalists and the Jeffersonians, were unorganized and the electoral system was in need of serious tweaking. As it was, a presidential contender could end up as his opponent's vice president or pitted against his own running mate, both of which happened to Thomas Jefferson. Something had to change.
And so the question is how you decide on one candidate. And they hit upon the idea of a caucus of party congressmen in Washington. Let them decide who the party's candidate should be.
So the congressmen in the caucuses would pick their party's candidates, and on election day, the states would vote for either the Federalist or the Jeffersonian. Only problem was, after the War of 1812, the Federalist Party pretty much dissolved, leaving just one functional party, which at first was a bit of a relief.
A lot of people were happy to say good riddance because it still held to that ideal that a president ought to be not a representative of a faction but a representative of the nation, like George Washington.
The prospect of a world without competing political parties led one newspaper to call it the era of good feelings.
Well, it wasn't an era of good feelings, and the problem is that parties may have gone away, but political disagreements didn't go away. So by 1824, the only mechanism at hand for deciding who's coming next is this old congressional caucus. But now that there's no Federalist Party, if you decide things in the congressional caucus, that means the congressional caucus is effectively deciding who the next president's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And the people are going to be left out of it altogether.
What was it about 1824 that made people say it's time to upset the apple cart?
The idea that the people really ought to elect their leaders was sweeping the country. It's implicit, you might say, in the Declaration of Independence and the idea of the United States as a republic, but it was now coming to fruition. It was becoming real. More and more states were providing for a popular vote for presidential electors. More and more states were empowering at least every adult white male to vote. So the idea of democracy by 1824 is very much in the air. And the idea that a handful of congressmen in Washington are going to pick the next president didn't go down well.
Which is why in 1824, three additional candidates opted to run against the caucus pick of William Crawford. They were House Speaker Henry Clay, Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, and war hero Andrew Jackson. Adams and Jackson both ran as outsiders. But whereas John Quincy Adams was the consummate politician, rough-hewn Andrew Jackson was not.
Jackson wasn't so much attacked as in the early stages of the campaign kind of dismissed for the reasons that he did not seem to have the vita, the resume, the qualifications, the background of a statesman.
He hadn't served as Secretary of State. He didn't speak any foreign languages. He'd never traveled abroad. In short, he was not the kind of person that was supposed to become president. But the people loved him. And when it came to the election, Jackson won the electoral vote. But not the presidency, due to the fact that he had only received a plurality of the votes, not the required majority.
So under the Constitution, the election went to the House of Representatives. What happened is that before the House voted, Henry Clay, who was out of the running, but was Speaker of the House and had a great influence, announced that he was going to vote for Adams on the grounds that Adams, like him or not, which Clay did not, was fit to be president of the United States. Whereas Jackson was just, in Clay's words, a mere military chieftain. What happened next is that Adams appointed Clay Secretary of State, and that's when Jackson hit the roof and called it a corrupt bargain. Partly because the Clay people and the Adams people had gone after each other fairly viciously during the 1824 campaign. So this looked like a bargain that could only be explained in terms of corruption.
What happened then after 1824? I mean, we have a phrase called Jacksonian democracy.
Jackson ran for president in 1828 as the people's vindicator, even the people's martyr after 1824. And he famously enunciated the idea that the country is supposed to be run for and by you and me, not banks and corporations. And Jackson originated that language in American politics. This is why the populists, why the New Deal Democrats, why the Great Society Democrats all venerated Jackson.
So essentially, the corrupt bargain that denied Jackson the presidency in 1824 backfired big time.
That's correct. Almost immediately, the 1828 campaign, which began, you might say, the day after the House elected Adams, was framed as a two-man contest, a national two-man contest, and that was new, and on the part of the Jackson people as a campaign to, you might say, to recapture American democracy.
Did 1824 ultimately give rise to the two-party system we have today?
Yes. Immediately after the House elected Adams, all of the people who were angry and frustrated about the result, that not only includes the Jackson people but also the Crawford people, coalesced behind Jackson's candidacy in 1828. And in 1828, you had for the first time, really, a national two-party popular contest for the presidency.
The first time?
Yes. There had been contested elections, seriously contested elections. But first, in most states, there was no popular vote at the time. By 1828, every state except one had a popular vote. So by 1828, you can vote for president. And it was a campaign conducted on a national stage. And so salting the mess of 1824, the chaos of 1824, down to a two-man national contest paves the way for those two personal presidential campaign coalitions to kind of solidify into national parties, which they did over the next few years.
Being a historian, do you see anything historic in the fight over the process that we're seeing right now?
I think we are still living in the shadow of 1824, in that if there was a message from 1824, and there was, it was virtue resides in the people, corruption resides in Washington. I think it's largely because of that, that there's never been an election that's gone to the House since 1824. What's happened in the 20th century with the advent of presidential primaries is that this idea that the people's will must not be thwarted has expanded outward from the election to the nominating process. And so now we are having people react with horror to the idea of a brokered convention in the same way that 1824 taught them to react with horror to the idea of a brokered election.
Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a delight.
Daniel Feller is a professor of history at the University of Tennessee and director of The Papers of Andrew Jackson.
Coming up, a loophole that may allow campaigns to collude with super PACs. I mean, there ought to be a law.
This is On the Media.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As we heard, partisan infighting is not limited to the GOP, but in the modern era, it's possible to outsource your mudslinging. Last week, the pro-Hillary Clinton super PAC called Correct the Record announced the launch of a digital task force called Barrier Breakers. Citing lessons learned from run-ins with the so-called Bernie bros, the Barrier Breakers will, quote, serve as a resource for supporters looking for positive content and pushback to share with their online progressive communities. In English, social media platforms like Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, and Instagram may soon be flooded by legions of paid pro-Hillary trolls to combat the anti-Clintonites. And Correct the Record will spend $1 million on the effort. Libby Watson is a staff writer at the Sunlight Foundation. She says that at the moment, it's unclear who even the targets will be of the Barrier Breakers' efforts.
Not everybody accepts the existence of Bernie Bros, or rather that they're a real phenomenon. But the idea is that there is a contingent of vocal and rude Bernie supporters online who harass Hillary supporters. Some people think that they're sexist or even racist. That's supposedly what the new Correct the Record project aims to combat. But it's definitely true that everybody's supporters can be kind of nasty.
Okay, so for the purposes of this conversation, let's just assume that Hillary as a woman is uniquely victimized by this particular crowd. Let's just say the Clinton campaign is now coordinating with the super PAC, Correct the Record, not just to correct the record, but to actually go after individual commenters. How's it supposed to work?
Now, they say that they've already tweeted at 5,000 people who have attacked Hillary Clinton. I don't know where those tweets are. Barrier Breakers has its own Twitter account, but it only has about 100 tweets. So it's not coming from there. Maybe it's coming from Correct the Record employees. The press release said that they were going to hire people to go online. But again, it's really difficult to see the effects of that, at least so far. They've also said that all they're doing is pushing out positive messaging about Hillary Clinton.
Is there any evidence that any of the other campaigns are doing anything similar, but just haven't issued press releases?
If this is successful, I wouldn't be surprised if it's a model that's replicated. But as far as we know, there isn't this sort of activity happening online. Because, you know, a lot of this stuff is organic. The armies of Bernie supporters online and the Trump supporters that many, many of us have encountered on Twitter, you know, they're just really fired up. It's definitely interesting to see a super PAC jumping into this role.
Aha. And here is where I have kind of buried the lead. Because to read about a super PAC coordinating with the campaign directly to either tweet out corrective messages or to recruit Hillary followers to do the same seems to be an explicit violation of the campaign finance laws that absolutely prohibit coordination between super PACs and their so-called soft money with campaigns themselves. Correct the Record thinks it's found a loophole. Tell me what that loophole is and if it's the real deal.
The rule that they're talking about is a 2006 FEC rule. It's called the Internet Exemption, and it was basically designed to allow bloggers and other individuals to put stuff online that was supportive of their candidate without having to declare it to the FEC as what's called a public communication, basically like an ad. And like I said, this is from 2006, and the original rule actually makes pretty funny reading now. It's sort of explaining how, did you know people can go online and they can write blogs on sites like blogger.com?
They do this directly into their computing machine.
Right, exactly. They type on the internet. And so obviously this is not only a different era of the internet, but also a different era of campaign finance. That was pre-Super PAC, 4 years before Citizens United. And so what Correct the Record is doing, because they don't run ads, they're not doing coordinated communications, and communications has a specific meaning, means basically paid ads. They're only putting stuff online for free. They can coordinate with the campaign. Now, a lot of people question that for free bit because obviously they have to pay staffers.
Yeah, they question it because it's not true. While the posting may itself not be paid for in the way that you pay for a TV commercial,
Correct the Record has said in its own press release that it's going to spend $1 million.
It's sort of like they're trying to have it both ways. They're trying to get the good press from saying they're going to spend $1 million on this effort, but they're also trying to say that they're not really spending money in the way that the FEC would regulate. The interesting thing is that this issue actually came up recently before the FEC in 2014, 2015, and the Republicans on the FEC were citing the internet exemption to say that the FEC shouldn't regulate what's on the internet. So it's kind of interesting to see a huge Democratic super PAC agreeing with the Republicans on the FEC, especially because, you know, Hillary Clinton does talk about campaign finance reform, and then she has this super PAC that is absolutely pushing the boundaries. So they're aware of the fact that the FEC is pretty much out to lunch on these issues. They're not really able or willing to enforce the law.
Can you explain why it is so toothless and ineffectual?
Well, in many ways, it's set up to fail because it has three Democrats and three Republicans, and they basically deadlock on every issue. It has got pretty extreme in the last few years. I mean, recently there was a long debate over whether they would use the word the or a in a rule. So they really can't get anything done.
So just to recap, we have an expenditure of approximately $1 million to fund messaging that you really haven't quite been able to figure out what it looks like and who's producing it.
Right.
Based on a pretty thin read of a legal argument with no evidence of it having any effect whatsoever. Is that kind of the story in a nutshell?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the press release was only put out last week, so it may be that over time we see some more solid evidence of what they're doing, but it's backfired for them in a way already, because now if you go and look on the Bernie Sanders Reddit, they're accusing already everyday Hillary supporters of being paid Correct the Record trolls.
Is there the possibility here that by deploying these SWAT teams, the campaign is going to do itself more harm than good?
I mean, it's certainly possible. Bernie supporters and many people are responding to what they see as too much money in politics and a general sense that they don't have a say.
And what about your very own Sunlight Foundation, which itself is chartered to encourage transparency in government and in politics? If this loophole is for real, does that worry you about other campaign activities being outsourced too?
Absolutely, yeah, because setting a precedent like this, where the only spending that counts is ad spending, is definitely very dangerous, because that's far from the only thing a super PAC can do.
Libby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Libby Watson is a staff writer at the Sunlight Foundation.
Correct the Record declined our request for an interview.
The accusations of misogyny and racism leveled by Correct the Record against Bernie Bros are, to be sure, darkly commonplace on the internet. Sketchy, paid political trolling, genuine agenda trolling, personal harassment, general idiocy, and simply uninhibited id have found a natural habitat in comments sections, where they thrive. In such a hostile environment, some news organizations and social sites have opted to end their comment sections. Others, who see comment as part of their mission, have taken a different tack. Among them, The Guardian, a media outlet that has done substantial research on the 70 million comments left on its site since 2006.
We think about the numbers of people who use the internet. 3/4 of those people have experienced some sort of abuse on the internet.
Mary Hamilton, executive editor of Audience at The Guardian, says it's been quite an education.
This is a massive, massive thing, which is affecting an awful lot of people. So the idea was to take this seriously as a journalistic subject, to look at it deeply.
It didn't take very long for some things to jump right out at you. And one is that there are particular categories of writers on The Guardian site who were most victimized by abusive comments.
Yeah, that's right. What we found was that among the writers, of the 10 regular writers who'd had the largest proportions of abusive comments, 8 were women and 2 were black men. That's quite stark. Of the 10 writers who'd had the least abuse, all were white men. That's also quite stark.
Well, under those circumstances, it's easy to understand why some news organizations, faced with the choice of an open fray or moderated comments or just no comments at all, just pulled the switch on this. I mean, that's what On the Media did. We said the quality of the discourse is so low and it's used as an opportunity for people with dubious motives. Why facilitate this kind of behavior?
I think it's fair to say that we do see tremendous value in the comments as well as the difficult stuff. And as we're moving towards a strategy that relies on our readers and relationships with those readers, it doesn't really make sense to hand off one of the biggest ways that we have of having a conversation with our readers to external platforms like Facebook, where these conversations are already happening. We can't stop people from having conversations about our journalism, but what we can do is give them a place to have those conversations and then try to make that place as productive as it can possibly be. Like when our readers take us to task for getting something wrong, that makes our journalism better. When our readers come into a thread and say, hey, I know about this, I experienced this, we can talk to them, we can bring their experience into our work. That broadens what we do.
I had a column for a couple of years in your paper online, and there were a lot of comments, and it struck me more than anything else to be a kind of social space mm-hmm. where the usual suspects showed up and said their piece, often with only the most tenuous connection to the subject of my column. I'm not sure what value there was to it, but people seem to have found a community.
Yeah. For example, we have a quick crosswords community. They are some of my favorite commenters because they all log on at roughly the same time when the crossword is posted. And they have a real life meetup that happens once a year. They've written their own theme song.
The Guardian's grid is black and white. It's red by day, it's red by night.
There's this beautiful little blossoming of people who found like-minded individuals through our platform. It's usual for news organizations to think of ourselves only really as publishers, but they're using The Guardian as a signal of the sorts of people that they want to have a conversation with. I think it's hugely important that we enable that at the same time as trying to address the darker side.
Because in addition to helping the crossworders collaborate on the day's puzzle, it's a platform for death threats. It's a platform for some of the most racist and sexist rhetoric. So don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, but clean up the water.
Yeah.
How?
So first up, I think it's important to say The Guardian doesn't see very much of that very extreme abuse that you're talking about. It's vanishingly rare on our platform. You know, we're not 4chan. We're not even YouTube. We don't have the same kinds of problems in those spaces that some other organizations do. But this is something that takes work. I find it really interesting that when people talk about spam being a problem, there's this real sense of understanding that, yeah, spam is a problem. It degrades the user experience. It's something that every open platform has to deal with at some point in its growth cycle. It has to start to address the problem of people abusing their platform to send messages that other users don't want to receive. And that is literally the definition of some of this abuse and harassment. So if most of our conversations now, or a huge number of them, are happening online, mediated through text-based platforms, that changes how we talk. And this is going to be a process that The Guardian can't solve on its own. But it is something where we have a responsibility, I think, to start to lead the way.
Europe happens to be at a point in history where the refugee crisis and Islamophobia and economic problems have given rise to very robust far-right parties in almost every country in Western Europe. And the rhetoric from politicians is itself sketchy. How do you enforce the conversation among the civilians if you have truly inflammatory speech coming from the mouth of the politicians?
I think that's a really interesting question. How you moderate a comment thread when the range of acceptable discourse has shifted a long way away from the conversations that we as an organization might want to host and might want to have is really genuinely tricky, because it puts you in the position of saying, is it ever acceptable to have a comment thread in which the basic humanity of a group of people is denigrated, because that's the conversation that the politicians are having? For The Guardian, what we have tried to do is narrow the topic of conversation so that it's very clear what is under discussion and that that's not the basic humanity of refugees, for example. I think one of the impacts of having unmoderated spaces on the internet is that the people with the largest axes to grind are the people who get to have their voice heard. If you have somebody who is perfectly happy to copy-paste the same response 100 times in a comment thread, that person is going to appear as though their voice has more weight than the one person who writes one very, very carefully considered comment. So what we're trying to look at is how do we unpick that? How do we give these voices equal weight and equal understanding?
Mary, many thanks.
You're very welcome.
Mary Hamilton is executive editor of Audience at The Guardian.
From fair Australia's burning sands to golden hills and far-off lands, we have a voice which must be heard. We are the ones who cross the words.
Coming up, the disappearance of 43 students in Mexico may finally force a kind of reckoning, maybe.
This is On the Media.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This weekend, a group of eminent international legal experts is leaving Mexico without the clear answer they came for. Why did 43 students vanish on the night of September 26, 2014, never to be seen again?
The classrooms they should be in now serve as both a memorial and a base for the parents as they continue to search for their sons.
Those students who attended Ayotzinapa Teachers College were a promising group from a severely impoverished part of the country.
To make a living, young men either head north to the United States to cross the border or get drafted into the army or join the drug gangs. These students are the brightest kids from this area. It's considered very prestigious to get accepted into this teacher's college.
Francisco Goldman has been reporting on the case for the New Yorker's website.
For years, all the normal schools get together and have a convention. And this year, they had elected the kids from the Ayotzinapa Normal School to be in charge of gathering buses to take students from all the normal schools to Mexico City.
To get to that event, actually the commemoration of a 1968 student massacre, the students commandeered buses from the town of Iguala. Commandeering buses for this purpose was also a tradition. The authorities usually turned an indulgent blind eye to what essentially was hijacking. But on that night, in 2014, municipal police intercepted the buses, killed and injured several of the 100 students, and then disappeared 43 others. In response to national and global outcry, the Mexican government invited in that aforementioned team of legal experts, who were essentially expelled this week. They included a Guatemalan attorney general who'd brought genocide charges against a former dictator and a Colombian prosecutor of military malfeasance. For over a year, they rigorously scrutinized the government's version of what befell the missing 43, a narrative that, as novelist and journalist Francisco Goldman explains, has been officially dubbed the historical truth.
In October of 2014, the head attorney general announced that based on the confessions of gang members, the 43 students had been taken by the municipal police from Iguala and Cocula to the municipal dump and they're handed over to drug traffickers from the drug gang Guerreros Unidos in Iguala, who in their confessions said that they had burnt them alive in that dump. And that the people who burnt the bodies in this 12-hour massive bonfire were told to get rid of those remains and took them to a river where they dumped some of those remains in plastic bags. And the remains that were recovered from that river yielded the only positive DNA identification so far to one of the students. this seemed to confirm, according to the government, the truth of what they were alleging. So this was called the historical truth.
So how does the report of the investigators differ from the historic truth?
Okay, the historic truth was demolished by the first report the experts released on September 6th of last year. And don't forget, the experts were invited in through the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights because the worldwide outcry over the government's handling of this case backed the government into a corner. They never expected this expert group to respond with such an obsessive, thorough, coherent, legal masterpiece of investigation. First of all, they had a fire expert who showed that it was impossible to have burnt 43 bodies in that particular dump, okay? They showed that the government had ignored all kinds of testimony from the many students who survived, that it wasn't just municipal police, that federal authorities had been involved in the attacks. Federal police had attacked some of the buses. People from the local military base had been all over the place. And the students were being monitored from the moment they left Ayotzinapa by military intelligence, federal police, the whole time.
But why?
Why? This is the question they keep asking. The government strategy has been over and over to make it seem as if though it's all about whether the 43 were burned in the dump or not. They don't want to address the fact this was a massive operation involving all kinds of authorities.
Mm-hmm.
Because then why? Why would federal and military authorities be involved in an attack on teaching students?
Yeah.
I've been around the experts a lot. They were given 180,000 pages of witness testimony, anything the police had collected, unorganized. Angela Buitrago, who's been a prosecutor in the worst years in Colombia, she discovered a video from the bus station that the attorney general's office was apparently trying to hide. In their scenario, there were four buses. They found a fifth bus. Going through these massive papers, she calls up one of the other experts at 5 a.m. saying, I just found this handwritten confession from the bus driver. He confirms the student survivor's version that the fifth bus was stopped by federal police, not municipal police. They just wanted the bus. The students were taken off the bus. They ran off up into the hills. What's going on? They discover that there's a case in federal court in the United States about heroin traffickers from this town, Iguala, from this gang, who are trafficking heroin to the United States in commercial buses. Now you begin to see a scenario. Why is every bus trying to leave that city that night attacked? Don't forget, they attacked a bus carrying a soccer team that had nothing to do with the students. They were clearly under orders to not let any bus escape the security cordon. And the most reasonable hypothesis right now is that an alarm went out. Maybe the students accidentally took a bus loaded with heroin. The experts demand to see the bus. So they're shown a bus. They compare it to the bus in the bus station security camera, send it to a video forensic expert in the United States.
Wow.
Who tells them it's not the same bus. Then they ask to meet the bus driver. It's not the same bus driver, right?
Wow.
Who, of course, denies having written that handwritten letter. And so when the September 6th informant came out,
the investigator's first report.
Yes. And did such a good job demolishing the historical truth. The attorney general resigns. That investigative unit that was responsible for the historical truth is taken off the case. They felt like maybe the government is going to be serious. We're going to go forward and get to the bottom of this.
Hmm.
The experts give January 8th as the day everything changed.
January 8th.
Yeah, where all of a sudden collaboration stopped. They were supposed to go out into the mountains and look for grave sites that day. Those trips were canceled. And at that point, an orchestrated media campaign begins trying to defame each of the experts individually.
This is in Mexico's biggest newspapers.
It starts with plants, often, in the scummy little right-wing paper called La Razón. It's a bit like a low-circulation New York Post. And stories get planted there, and then they get picked up by Milenio, Excelsior, Universal, you know, the bigger mainstream papers, and, of course, the TV stations.
One of the strands was that they were getting paid an inappropriately high salary for the job that they were doing. What else was there?
If you're a good independent prosecutor, wherever you are, you're going to make enemies. So they have these sort of right-wing citizens groups in Mexico who went to these countries and found their enemies and brought them to Mexico. So you had really absurd things like the Guatemalan Attorney General, Claudia Paz y Paz. They accused her of having abetted President Pérez Molina's corruption, which is so ridiculous. Pérez Molina is now in jail for corruption. He had her terminated from her job 7 months before it was supposed to end. She was obviously a crusader against corruption, and she, of course, became internationally renowned when she brought the genocide charge against former dictator Rios Montt. I mean, this woman is a dynamo. Every one of the experts got attacked on something like that. And all throughout this, the experts demanded, among other things, to interview the military. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was continually denied. They asked the PGR, which is the Attorney General's office, to open a formal inquiry in the United States about the bus case. And they dragged their feet on that. And only a few weeks ago, when it was obvious that the expert's term was not going to be renewed, did they finally do that.
So this past week, the final report of the investigation was released. What was the mood?
Well, they presented the report in a university in downtown Mexico City. The place was jammed, this beautiful old colonial courtyard. The family members, you know, the mothers and fathers of those disappeared boys who have become symbols throughout Mexico and throughout the world and fighters on behalf of the tens of thousands of disappeared people in Mexico. Right? This was like a collective hope that somehow these boys, these 43 boys, stood for all the disappeared. And if we could begin to show a seriousness in Mexico about resolving this case, maybe there'd be hope for other cases. So there were the family members. And they began to chant, you know, no se vayan, you know, don't leave, don't leave, don't abandon us. It was really sad. I know the experts are really worried about what's going to happen to the families. I mean, one of the things that most moved me was just this moment where they were talking about, like, well, we were never allowed to question the military. So in the press conference right after, someone says, what would you have asked the military? Claudia Paz y Paz, the former Guatemalan Attorney General. Mm-hmm. She said, well, one question we would have asked them is, you know, it's been proven that they knew what was going on. They were out in the streets. They saw wounded students. Some people even brought wounded to the gates of the battalion headquarters, and they were turned away. And she said, we would have asked them, why didn't you do anything to stop it? You know, the army? Of course they could have stopped it.
There was a recent New York Times op-ed written by the former Mexico City correspondent Ginger Thompson. Mm-hmm. She said that Mexican officials are more concerned about their image abroad than with the corruption and violence at home, like they really care about the insults hurled at Mexico by Donald Trump recently. She wrote, and I wonder what you think of this, Mr. Trump is partly used by the government as a distraction. It's simpler to focus on foreign demons rather than on internal ones.
I think that they definitely used Trump to distract. They used El Chapo Guzman to distract. The whole show at Sean Penn and everything. I just think that there's no easy answer to the problem of institutional corruption in Mexico. It's so deep. But things have happened in the aftermath of this press conference, by the way, that are really interesting. They're going to make it very hard for the Mexican government prosecutors to just close the case now that the experts are gone and now that outside vigilance seems to have vanished. The Inter-American Commission for Human Rights is intent on staying involved. I think they've been surprised by the level of international media attention over the last week that the report has gotten and the very negative reaction all over the world to the experts being forced to leave. And evidence, like the allegations of torture, allegations caught on video that suggest planting of evidence by a key prosecutor in the case, that these things are opening potential paths to keep this case very much alive and maybe provoke another chapter in the investigation.
Francisco, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Francisco Goldman has been reporting on Mexico's missing 43 for TheNewYorker.com. He is also the author of The Interior Circuit, A Mexico City Chronicle, and Say Her Name.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Dasha Lizitsina. We had more help from our intern, David Conrad, who is leaving us this week to finish his dissertation. Good luck, David. We hope you come back very soon. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Casey Means and Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.